In the early morning hours of August 12, 1984, 13-year-old Eugene Martin got dressed and went off to his job working as a newspaper delivery boy for the Des Moines Register. Sometime after retrieving his papers, Gene disappeared in a startlingly similar fashion to Johnny Gosch, who had been abducted from the same streets just 2 years earlier. For 36 years, the Des Moines police and Gene's family have struggled with a lack of evidence in leads, leaving only possibilities of what might have become of the teenager. For their part, investigators conducted wide-ranging searches, questioned everyone in Gene's life and in town, and through it all were able to develop a partial description of a potential suspect. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 122, The Abduction of Eugene Martin. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the haunting abduction of Eugene Martin. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also available on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon available at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions directly through the website or email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Just 2 years after Johnny Gosch was abducted, Eugene Martin was taken under extremely similar circumstances, leading many to believe that the two cases must be linked. This is episode 122. The Abduction of Eugene Martin. Early in the morning on Sunday, September 5th, 1982, 12-year-old Johnny Gosch left his family's home in the suburb of West Des Moines, Iowa, to work on his paper route. Typically, Johnny would wake his father, John, who would accompany him. However, on this particular morning, Johnny left without doing so. Multiple witnesses, including other paper carriers, reported seeing Johnny arriving that morning to pick up the papers for delivery, though this is generally considered the last official sighting of Johnny, corroborated by multiple witnesses. Two independent witnesses later reported seeing Johnny speaking with an older man in a blue car, possibly a two-tone Ford Fairmont. At least one witness reported that the man driving the car appeared to be following Johnny after the conclusion of their conversation. At approximately 6 a.m., after receiving multiple calls from customers who had not yet received their papers along Johnny's route, his father set out to try and track down his son to determine what the problem was. Just two blocks from the family home, John discovered his son's wagon, filled with newspapers for delivery, but Johnny was nowhere to be found. After this discovery, the Gosch family immediately contacted police to report their child missing, though they later noted police were slow in their response, and it took approximately 45 minutes before authorities would accept the report. The disappearance of Johnny Gosch has become a notorious case, one which has been covered extensively in the media, on podcasts, and in documentaries. It's a complex case filled with twists and turns, disputes over information, and it is rife with speculation. It's a terrifying story which has, in many ways, become a cautionary tale that has worked to advance the way law enforcement and the media approach child disappearances. However, in the early years surrounding Johnny's disappearance and likely abduction, the wheels were slow to move. 23 months after Johnny's disappearance, an eerily similar disappearance took place. Just over 7 miles from the spot in which it's believed Johnny was abducted, another boy on his morning paper route vanished without a trace. His name is Eugene Wade Martin, and his disappearance, aside from bearing a striking resemblance to Johnny's, also managed to usher in a lot of speculation that there might be a direct connection and perhaps both children could have been taken by the same person or persons. Eugene Wade Martin was born on August 17, 1970. The child was nicknamed Gene, and by all accounts, he was a polite, quiet, and somewhat shy kid. Gene was an active youngster, enjoying activities such as football, skateboarding, and fishing. Very much a child coming into the 80s, Gene had been pulled into the world of video games, and when he wasn't playing a game, he indulged himself in television watching, be it sports or the latest Saturday morning cartoon. Gene's mother, Janice, later stated, quote, "He likes football, but he's pretty small for that, and he loves skateboarding. He almost always has skinned up knees and elbows, but he always gets right back on," end quote. When Gene wasn't playing with friends or relaxing at home, he had an early morning job he hoped would put a little extra money in his pocket. On weekends, Gene would awake early in the morning and, in the company of his older brother Don, head down to gather up newspapers to distribute. At the time, he was a carrier for the Des Moines Register, and he'd picked up the job just a few months earlier, in May. Gene was born to parents Donald and Janice, though at the time of his disappearance, he was staying with Donald. They had moved to the area in April. Donald had remarried, and as a result, Gene found himself with 5 half-brothers and 2 half-sisters, and while such situations can often be turbulent, everyone seemed to love the 13-year-old. Several of his siblings have gone on to describe him as the baby of the family, someone they tried to look out for and someone whose company they enjoyed. That was very much the case heading into what was to be an exciting week for Gene. As the weekend of August 12th approached, there were several things going on in Gene's life that he and his family were very much looking forward to. The Iowa State Fair was in town, and Gene was hoping to put some paper money to good use, buying tickets to ride and maybe play a game or two. Beyond that, his 14th birthday was approaching, and while Gene didn't know at the time, his father had plans to purchase a brand new bike to gift him. The party plans were set, and everyone was looking forward to spending some time with the birthday boy, but fate had different plans, and just 5 days before the party, Gene mysteriously disappeared in the early morning hours in the midst of his newspaper delivery route. On the night of August 11th, Gene's older brother Don was spending the night at a friend's house, and when the morning of the 12th rolled around, he wasn't home to accompany Gene on his route. Gene himself had gone out on Saturday night, seeing a movie with friends before heading home early, wanting to get enough sleep for work. When he woke, Don wasn't there, but Gene wasn't going to let that stand in his way as he wanted to get that payday to go to the fair. Reportedly, Gene woke up on time to get ready to go to work and did so without disturbing anyone in the home. His father, Donald, later told the Des Moines Register, quote, "I heard the alarm go off this morning, but that's all. I didn't even hear him getting dressed," end quote. Indeed, it seems Gene got up and dressed and went on his way to work. He was to report to the corner of Southwest 14th Street and Highview Drive, where he would be given his papers for that morning's deliveries. Connie Cloenberch, an older man living in the area, had gotten up early that Sunday to get in a few rounds of golf. He later reported that, driving towards the course, he passed by 14th and Highview, at which time he noticed Gene sitting on the corner with his empty paper bag beside him at approximately 5:10 a.m. Connie later told reporters that he waved to Gene, who returned the wave, and there didn't appear to be anything out of the ordinary at the time. After picking up the papers for that day's deliveries, Gene apparently began the prep process, folding and rubber banding each paper before inserting it into his carrier bag. Paul Porter was the route manager and later reported that he came by at one point and saw Gene's bag, loaded with papers as though it was ready to go, but he didn't see Gene anywhere. At the time, Porter assumed Gene had grabbed a few handfuls of papers to deliver and would return for the rest. It's been reported in multiple sources that this sighting took place sometime between 6 and 6:15 a.m. Shortly thereafter, Porter received several calls from customers explaining that they hadn't yet received their morning paper. One customer in particular noted that she could see the bag of papers at the corner, and she wondered if she could walk over and just take one. Porter assured the customers they'd receive their papers and returned to the scene, and once again, found Gene's bag lying in the same place it had been when he was there earlier. At approximately 7:15 a.m., Porter placed a call to Donald Martin, explaining that he hadn't seen Gene and the boy had failed to deliver his papers that morning. According to the Des Moines Register, Donald then began searching the house under the assumption that Gene may not have gone into work. At this time, the only person who had seen Gene that morning was Connie. The route manager had only seen his bag. After determining that Gene wasn't in the home and must have gone to work, Donald contacted his brother Ron, and the two began going around the city looking for Gene. Donald later told the Register, quote, "We both have motorcycles. We went to the malls, we looked behind schools, all over," end quote. Unfortunately, despite working a tight search through the area, neither Don nor Ron came across Gene or anyone who had seen him. After looking through every corner of the area, Donald returned home, at which time he phoned the police to report Gene missing. Considering just 2 years earlier, authorities had faced a very similar situation with Johnny Gosch, the response was rapid and the similarities were noted. Des Moines police responded, calling in 6 tactical unit officers to lead and assist 5 detectives in an initial search. Beyond that, investigators gathered what they called a fact sheet bearing Gene's image and vital statistics, which was distributed to those taking part in the search. Sergeant William Mullins spoke with the newspaper discussing their approach to the search, reporting that, in addition to police officers, they also had assistance from local volunteers, including the Capital City Knights football team. It didn't take long for Gene's information to be passed to other departments, though, with Mullins telling the Quad City Times, quote, "The search is done by making the information available to all cars on the street. In that sense, it's citywide," end quote. The initial search began at approximately 8:40, just over 3 hours since the last sighting of Gene. While news of Gene's disappearance was quickly spreading across the city, the main area of the search focused in the southwest, the location in which Gene's newspaper bag had been located. It was believed at the time that Gene was likely still in that area, or at least it was hoped he was. Initially, authorities weren't sure what they were dealing with, and it was considered possible that the 12-year-old had gotten lost or wandered off distracted by something. Barbara Mack, general counsel for the Register, expressed frustration and concern with the situation, explaining that they had instituted a carrier safety training program, which they hoped would help avoid any such situations happening in the aftermath of Johnny Gosch. In response to Gene's disappearance, the Register began offering a $5,000 reward for information related to his location. By the next day, that reward would increase to $25,000. Beyond that, notices were placed inside the papers about the child's disappearance, and an additional warning was inserted for all carriers to be on the lookout, not just for Gene, but for anyone behaving suspiciously or hanging around their routes. Supervisors from the paper were also sent out to watch over the carriers as they gathered their papers and worked their routes. For a moment, there was consideration given that Gene may have run off as the result of a domestic dispute, according to the Quad City Times, but Sergeant Mullins expressed they had ruled that out rather quickly. Within hours of the initial search beginning, police felt quite confident they were dealing with foul play, with Sergeant Mullins stating, quote, "We are treating it as an abduction or kidnapping," end quote. As part of the search, officers were sent along Gene's route, going door to door to question residents about whether or not they had seen Gene or anything out of the ordinary. At least one resident reported witnessing an exchange when Connie drove by and waved to Gene, but beyond that, they weren't receiving much information. However, they did receive 2 pieces of concerning news. Firstly, there was a report of a green car in poor shape lurking in the area around 14th and 18th streets that morning, within the range of where Gene reported for work. According to the Register, the vehicle was driven by a white male believed to be in his late 20s or early 30s, with short, dark hair parted in the middle and 2 to 3 days worth of beard growth. The man had been reported for possibly following 2 young women who were in the area at that time. The car was last seen at approximately 5 a.m., right around the time Gene would have been getting up for work. And while police had nothing to link the man to the child's disappearance, They did express their interest in speaking with the driver in terms of what he may have seen that morning. Another witness came forward, this time reporting having witnessed an unidentified man speaking with Jean the morning he vanished. While the time isn't exactly known, papers have reported that the conversation had likely taken place between 5:15 and 5:45 a.m. According to the witness, he saw a man dressed in light-colored clothing having what appeared to be a friendly conversation with Jean, though he was not close enough to hear the actual context of that conversation. The description was admittedly vague, with police issuing a notice to be on the lookout for a white male between 30 and 40 years old, standing between 5 feet 9 and 6 feet tall. The man was described as having a medium build and medium length hair. In addition, he was described as being clean shaven and neat in appearance. No vehicle was witnessed at the time. Within a few days, five other witnesses came forward claiming to have also seen that man speaking to Jean. Sergeant Mullins was less than excited about the vagueness, explaining, quote, "This is not a very good description. It describes a lot of people," end quote. Not looking for a repeat of what had happened in the initial days after Johnny Gosch had disappeared, police spared no time in reaching out to federal authorities for assistance. Special Agent Herbert Hawkins, the man who led the FBI's Omaha office, traveled to Des Moines bringing along 16 FBI agents to assist in the search and other matters related to the case, according to the Register. News of Jean's disappearance was spread through local papers, radio, and televised news, and these reports resulted in dozens of calls coming into the department. The FBI, along with the Des Moines police, worked to sort through and track down all possible leads. Sergeant Mullins later explained, quote, "The phones rang all night Sunday. The officers made out lead sheets on each one, and all of them will be followed up," end quote. In addition to following up on the leads, the main search for Jean expanded to include isolated locations throughout the city, including but not limited to parks, warehouses, riverfronts, and other less populous locations. At that point, the search team had expanded to include 25 Des Moines police officers, in addition to the 16 FBI agents, as well as local volunteers, friends, and family. However, despite the team and the search radius beginning to expand, police were absolutely frustrated by their utter lack of leads or developments. They were unable to find anything connected to Jean, but they weren't ready to give up on their search. In the meantime, promotion of the disappearance was increased in the media, and the police produced and mass-distributed flyers bearing Jean's image, vital statistics, and details about his last known whereabouts. When asked about the time, which had already passed, Sergeant Mullins noted how vital the first hours are, telling the Gazette, quote, "The longer in time sequence after the crime, the less chance there is for it to be solved," end quote. In response to the stories being printed about Jean, several newspapers reached out to the family of Johnny Gosch, who were heartbroken to hear that another young boy had been abducted from the streets of Des Moines in a very similar fashion. Both John Gosch and his wife Noreen were critical of the work police had done during their own son's disappearance and advised the Martins that they must remain strong and do whatever they had to do to keep Jean's name alive in the media. The Gosch family offered their condolences and said that they would do anything they could to assist the Martins in trying to locate Jean. In terms of the abduction itself, it was hard not to consider the possibility that the same person could have been responsible. John Gosch explained, quote, "We have to realize that the person or people who kidnapped Johnny are still out there," end quote. The Gosch family later met with the Martins. On Monday, the 13th, police established a hotline specifically for tips related to Jean's disappearance. While they received hundreds of calls, a police spokesman explained that many of the calls were concerned people who wished to give advice on where to look rather than anyone actually delivering information about the crime itself. That same day, a man stopped by the Martin home to explain that he had witnessed a young boy who appeared to have been bruised riding in a car near 14th Street. After seeing Jean's flyer, the man thought there could be a connection, though nothing appears to have developed out of this information. On Tuesday, August 14th, Police were contacted by one of the people witnesses had seen in the area that morning. The man who had been driving the green car was brought in for questioning, though police were frustrated to acknowledge that there didn't appear to be a link between the man and Jean's abduction. In briefing the Martin family, Des Moines police explained that the man admitted to being in the area that morning, but said that he had been dropping off his wife at work. Through their own efforts, police managed to verify the man's alibi, and he was quickly written off from the case. While this helped them narrow their field, so to speak, their field was extremely broad. There was information circulating at the time that police had discovered blood near the location where Jean had last been seen, though this turned out to be nothing more than an unfounded rumor. Police spoke out through the media about how important it was for potential witnesses to be accurate in their information and to avoid any kind of speculation or sensationalism. Meanwhile, search parties were organizing all over the city, groups of volunteers coming forward to try and assist in whatever ways they could. Two boys living in Jean's neighborhood spent their Monday afternoon handing out flyers, while Jean's uncle, Roger Blanchard, began organizing his own search groups to span out further throughout the city and surrounding areas, telling the Register, quote, "We're going down to the wooded and grassland areas, Walnut Woods State Park, culverts, pretty much all over. What we don't cover today, we'll cover tomorrow. We need all the volunteers we can get," end quote. Later that evening, police received an anonymous tip from a caller who claimed to have witnessed Jean speaking with the unidentified man. According to the caller, he saw the man standing near a 1972 or 73 green Chevrolet Malibu with gray primer marks. The caller went on further explaining that, in the conversation he witnessed, the man had at least once placed his hands on Jean. The caller, though, chose not to identify himself and stated that he was only delivering the information with the hope that it could help the case. By Wednesday the 15th, the FBI were trying to follow up on the same man mentioned by the caller. According to the Iowa City Press-Citizen, a specialist was called in from Washington to re-interview the six witnesses in hopes of compiling an artist composite. At the time, law enforcement acknowledged that the man was not considered a suspect, but they were very interested in locating and speaking with him. That same day, Jean's parents were scheduled to meet with Governor Terry Branstad. At the same time, police acknowledged that the search for Jean was now moving outside of the city limits, and additional resources had been requested by surrounding police departments. One particular search included members of the Civil Air Patrol and went through the tall weeds and wooded areas southwest of the city. A line of searchers stretched out over 200 yards wide as they fought their way through the thick wilderness. While other Des Moines police were answering routine calls, they were also spending their free time trying to search for Jean as well. Later that Wednesday, police recovered a tennis shoe and a pair of shorts near the last location that Jean had been seen. While initially this gave police hope they could develop more of a lead, it later was determined that neither article of clothing belonged to Jean, and things were reset back to square one for the most part. The reward for information increased to $30,000 during the week as the Iowa Newspaper Association chipped in. Following the meeting with Governor Branstad, Donald Martin expressed his appreciation for the man's concern and his devotion to the case, which Branstad had described as personal to him. The family were granted access to the investigation itself with Tom Ruxlow, the chief of the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigations, giving them an invitation, according to the Register. It was during this time that reporters asked questions of Donald about who he believed could possibly be responsible for his son's abduction. Donald replied, quote, "It had to be somebody Jean could trust. He was not the type to walk up to someone," end quote. There were a lot of reports at the time that Jean was extremely shy and avoided speaking with anyone he didn't know. When asked about the possibility of developing a psychological profile of the abductor, Special Agent Hawkins expressed frustration that they didn't have enough to work with to do a full profile. Hawkins explained that the lack of a crime scene and physical evidence made the profile nearly impossible, though he did express that, in his opinion, the type of people who commit these crimes are, quote, normally introverts, loners, and don't confide in other people. In fact, they have few friends. End quote. Unfortunately, while the investigation was still in the early days, outside of a few witnesses, police had little to work with. Sergeant Mullins expressed his frustration, telling the Sioux City Journal, quote, "When it started, they had absolutely nothing, no evidence, no witnesses. This is the sort of investigation that could drag out. It's drudge work following those leads." End quote. By Thursday, the 16th, the search had become desperate. Volunteers and police were scouring the city and surrounding areas, looking through garbage cans and dumpsters in hopes of finding anything connected to the case. Any bags found were cut open and dumped out, all items being searched through before they were placed in new bags. Police rode along on garbage trucks for the search, and in total, more than 4,800 homes' trash were examined by investigators. Unfortunately, nothing was found. Around the same time, a large search was launched just south of Orlabor Road in the Anarchy Industrial District, utilizing a search helicopter and a large group of federal, state, and local law enforcement. Though they would not comment on what had drawn their focus to that particular area, it may have been related to a woman who had called the hotline not long before the search was launched. The area being searched was some 15 miles to the north of where Jean had last been seen. The prime search seemed to revolve around a cornfield and took place late at night, breaking in the morning before resuming and then finally ending later on Friday afternoon. Then President Ronald Reagan placed a call to the Des Moines Register that same day, offering his assistance and condolences. According to the Register, the call lasted approximately 5 minutes, and it was requested that Jean's missing persons flyer be added to all post offices throughout the country, to which President Reagan apparently replied that he would get on it. However, instead, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was brought in to work closely with police and distribute the flyers through their network. Local police also launched a new effort, reaching out to papers in the area to establish a standard program to ensure the safety of paper carriers, in addition to notifying carriers and their families about the dangers of potential abduction. August 17th marked the passing of Jean's 14th birthday. Rather than a celebration, there was just hope for his return. His parents kept themselves busy, communicating with investigators and working to draw more attention to the case. Jean's birthday cake was placed in the freezer, saving it for the teenager's return. Donald Martin later commented, quote, "It's for Jean when he comes home. He's going to get the first bite." End quote. By the 18th, 6 days after Jean's disappearance, little if anything had developed, but authorities were determined to continue their search efforts. Sergeant Mullins told the Register that no manpower had been reduced, and in fact, all days off had been canceled for that weekend to make more officers available for the investigation. Mullins also noted that they had received multiple tips from alleged psychics, noting that they had not sought out their assistance, and tracking down their tips was a strain on their manpower. A local grocery chain came forward, beginning production on shopping bags that would bear the images of both Jean and Johnny Gosch in hopes of raising local awareness on both cases. Sadly, though, as time continued passing, the amount of volunteers showing up to assist in searches began to dwindle, and with the case having no developments, it became difficult to continue dedicating so much manpower to it while other crimes were happening in town. Sergeant Mullins asked for more volunteers, expressing that police simply didn't have the numbers to dedicate to some of the more expansive searches they were conducting on the outskirts of town. When asked about the progress of the investigation, Mullins told the Quad City Times, quote, "The common feeling in the investigation is that there are people out there who have information who haven't contacted us." End quote. By the 23rd, the numbers had fallen off steeply. Approximately 24 volunteers showed up at the Des Moines Police Department to assist in a search along the banks of the Raccoon River. By this time, much of the volunteers were made up of family, friends, and local high school students who wanted to help in some way. However, despite the continued searches, Sergeant Mullins had the difficulty of expressing that the investigation was stalling, the case was growing cold, and unless they could find something new, their hopes of breaking things open was fading. Local churches mentioned Jean's case and tried to convince their congregations to commit themselves to volunteering in some of the searches. The reward offered for information in the case continued to steadily rise, hitting $88,500 by the 25th, but no one had yet provided information to earn themselves that cash. In the August 28th edition of the Quad City Times, police announced they were no longer asking for volunteers. Sergeant Mullins explained that all of the larger areas they had hoped to target had been searched with the use of volunteers, and that at that point, they were going to leave the searches up to police moving forward. Mullins noted that many of the areas had been searched more than once, and that while they were no longer seeking volunteers, the investigation was still very much ongoing. When reached for comment, Donald Martin stated, quote, "As long as they don't give up, I'm satisfied. If they give it up, then I'm going to come unglued," end quote. In early September, the reward reached $111,000. While this brought some hope that someone with information wouldn't be able to turn down that large sum of money, the changing of the month also brought back a lot of painful memories for the Gosch family. Johnny was abducted on September 5th, and this marked 2 years since they had seen their son. The family expressed their frustrations with investigators, who stated that they were still looking for Johnny. Noreen felt that if investigators had sprung into action as quickly for Johnny as they had for Jean, her son might have been found. Unfortunately, the investigation into Jean's disappearance began growing cold rapidly. In October, authorities announced a probe into the Des Moines Register's staff following up on allegations related to possible sexual assaults which had taken place involving some of the younger carriers. These allegations were brought to police by a private investigator who claimed to have obtained an admission from one of the men involved. There does not appear to be any major developments following an article written about the probe. In late December, sheriff's deputies out of Appanoose County followed up on a tip that a witness had called in. In the call, the witness claimed to have seen an adult male carrying a young boy who appeared limp under a highway bridge in the area of Centerville. Sheriff's deputies searched along the Chariton River, an area located approximately 85 miles southeast of Des Moines. While the search had been conducted throughout the day, the sheriff's office later reported that they hadn't found anything related to Jean Martin. By February of 1985, the Martin family was struggling financially. They'd spent a lot of money hiring private investigators, speaking with psychics, and taking out newspaper ads. There was some frustration expressed by Jean's mother, who claimed that police had ignored more than 150 tips that had been given by psychics. When reached for comment by the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Des Moines Police Chief William Mulder explained that tips weren't helpful, saying, quote, "The psychic leads, many of them, are vague. By way of example, the psychic lead that says the body of Eugene Martin is located near water. Well, terrific, that doesn't help a lot," end quote. Soon, time began passing at a more rapid pace. Days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years, with no news, no developments, no tips, and no leads. For the Martin family, it was devastating, and their suspicions became aroused of every situation. In a sense, Donald admitted, they appeared quite paranoid, and perhaps they were. The family had conducted multiple yard sales and mixed that money with donations, hoping to continue funding their efforts to find Jean, but as time was passing, money was going out faster than it was coming in. On March 29th, 1986, a year and a half after Jean had disappeared, another young boy went missing from the streets of Des Moines. 13-year-old Mark James Warren Allen left his home on Emma Avenue to visit a friend, but he never arrived. Very few details are available in Mark's case, though it appears investigators initially considered him a runaway. However, more than 34 years later, he's never been found. In the years following Mark's disappearance, there were several attempted abductions targeting young boys on the streets of Des Moines, though none of them were successful. However, it became clear for many that there were likely several predators active in the area. Whether or not they were direct connections to Gene, Johnny, or Mark has never been determined. Des Moines investigator Jim Rowley worked on Gene's case until his retirement in 2001. For years, he would meet with Donald on Friday evenings to discuss the case. Donald would ask questions, sometime offer up suggestions, and whatever he thought at the time, Rowley would try to run down. He later told Local 5 Iowa News, quote, "No matter what lead he had, I would go out and work it, and we never had a concrete lead," end quote. Over the course of his time working the investigation, Rowley traveled to both Canada and Mexico following up on leads. In total, Rowley estimates that he tracked down between 2,000 and 3,000 leads, none of which he found credible or reliable. In most instances, they were cases of mistaken identity, or in some, they were just wild goose chases. Rowley, though, had his own theories. It was his belief that the abductions of Johnny Gosch and Gene Martin were connected, either by the same individual or perhaps the same group of individuals. While he was unable to uncover solid evidence, it was also his belief that both boys had likely been killed shortly after their disappearances. For Rowley, this is the case he says he will take to his grave, with him explaining, quote, "You can leave a homicide at work. I know that sounds bizarre. You can leave a shooting or stabbing or robbery at work. But there's a boy missing, and all he was doing was delivering papers," end quote. On December 27, 2010, Donald Martin passed away after a long battle with Alzheimer's disease and colon cancer. To those who knew him, Donald had remained steadfastly devoted to trying to find his son, no matter what the cost. According to friends and family, Gene's case became Donald's life. He withdrew, divorcing Sue in the years following the disappearance and speaking to friends less and less. All of his spare time was dedicated to the search, to trying to track down leads, to trying to find Gene. Donald was only 65 years old. Gene's mother, Janice, passed away a few years earlier due to complications related to diabetes. Both parents went to their grave never knowing what became of their youngest child. In September of 2016, one of Gene's brothers, Mike, gave an interview with KCCI Des Moines News regarding his brother. Mike discussed his hope that one day they would get answers about what became of Gene, saying that it had become extremely difficult to live without knowing. Mike stated, quote, "Not knowing the answer has put a black spot on my heart, and I don't know if it will ever change, but I would like to take a deep breath and know what happened," end quote. In that same interview, Mike stated that it had been 12 years since the family had received any information about the investigation into Gene's disappearance. When last seen, Eugene Wade Martin was described as being a white male with brown hair and brown eyes, standing 5 feet tall and weighing approximately 110 pounds. Gene has a scar on his right knee and a previously fractured wrist. Gene was last seen wearing blue jeans, a gray and white striped midriff t-shirt with red sleeves, and blue Trax brand shoes. There is DNA available for analysis in this case. Witness sightings place Gene's last known location as being near Southwest 14th Street and Highview Drive, speaking to a yet unidentified older man. Gene has been missing since August 12, 1984, and if alive today, he would be turning 50 years old next month. He was just 13 when he disappeared. Gene Martin got up early in the morning to attend his paper route. Sometime between folding the papers and loading his carrier bag, he disappeared. Witnesses saw him speaking to an older man, though the description is extremely vague and the man he was last seen with has never been identified. It's been 36 years since Gene's family have seen him, and in that time both his mother and father have passed away. The torch is now carried by his siblings, who hope against hope that someday they will have an answer, that they will be able to bring Gene home and lay him to rest. Unfortunately, for the better part of 3 decades, there have been no developments in this extremely cold case. Whether you're working from home, on the go, or working on your fitness, you want what you're listening to be what you're listening to, not what the rest of your family is listening to. Everyone needs a great pair of wireless earbuds, but before you drop hundreds of dollars on a pair, check out wireless earbuds from Raycon. Did you know that Raycon earbuds start at about half the price of any other premium wireless earbuds on the market, and that they sound just as amazing as other top audio brands that you know? I was blown away by their sound, and I'm extremely picky about my earbuds. Their newest model, the Everyday E25 earbuds, are their best ones yet, with 6 hours of playtime, seamless Bluetooth pairing, and more bass and a more compact design that gives you a nice noise-isolating fit. Raycon's wireless earbuds are so comfortable, perfect for conference calls or binging podcasts. I've had a lot of experience with uncomfortable earbuds that just wouldn't stay in, but my Raycon earbuds fit comfortably and never fall out no matter how fast I'm moving. At the end of the day, I'm all about sound, comfort, and ease of use, and Raycon nails it on all three. I couldn't be more satisfied. Unlike some of your other wireless options, Raycon earbuds are both stylish and discreet, with no dangling wires or stems to distract anyone during video calls. The company was co-founded by Ray J, and celebrities like Snoop Dogg, Melissa Etheridge, and J.R. Smith are obsessed with Raycons. Now's the time to get the latest and greatest from Raycon. Get 15% off your order at buyraycon.com/trace. That's buyraycon.com/trace. For 15% off Raycon wireless earbuds, buyraycon.com/trace. 12-year-old Eugene Martin got up, got dressed, went down to collect newspapers and deliver them. We know he made it there. A witness saw him sitting on the curb, apparently waiting for the papers. We know the papers came, and at some point, Gene folded them together and rubber banded them, inserting them neatly into his carrier. What happened after that, however, is what has kept his case cold for 36 years. 6 witnesses came forward in the first days of the investigation telling a very similar story. Early in the morning, sometime between 5:15 and 5:45, they saw Gene talking to an unidentified older male. At least one person called in, not only claiming to have seen a vehicle, but also alleging that he saw the man put his hands on Gene, though in what way has never been specified. In one description, a police officer relayed what the encounter was described by a witness as appearing to look like, and that was a father-son conversation. What exactly that means, we can't be sure, but it certainly isn't what you imagine when you picture a child abduction. After that, there's nothing. No confirmed sightings, no demands for ransom, no anything. It's as if Gene vanished off the face of the earth. This case, all by itself, is completely disturbing and upsetting. When you factor in that this happened just 2 years after Johnny Gosch was taken, it makes things all the more frightening. There are some who argue the cases are connected. There are others who don't believe they are. However, as you stretch out over the years, you've then got the disappearance of Mark Allen. You have the addition of several attempted abductions in the years following Mark. For most, it seems, there's really only a few possibilities. Either you're looking for the same person or persons in all cases, or maybe some of the cases are connected, but not all of them. There's a lot of people who believe they were all independent abductions, but that's not something that can be completely ruled out, whether you agree or not. For many of the investigators who work Gene's case, if there is a connection, they believe it's likely tied between Johnny Gosch and Gene. The similarities, even down to both working as carriers for the Des Moines Register, are just too much to ignore. Some would argue that whoever abducted Johnny decided to use the same approach 2 years later when targeting Gene. It does raise certain questions, though, namely, where was this person for the 2 years in between? Detective Rowley himself asked that question, believing that a criminal of this type was unlikely to be disciplined enough to only strike at 2-year intervals. Of course, there are those who believe the abductor may not have stopped, but simply didn't return to Des Moines for 2 years. It's really difficult to say. I admit the similarities are there, and there's quite a few. Both Gene and Johnny were taken within 8 miles of one another. Both were of similar ages, a year apart to be precise. Looking at images of the two, they certainly resemble one another in the face, although their physical makeups were very different. Neither abduction left behind any indication of a struggle or violence, this being either due to the abductor being able to swiftly execute the crime, or perhaps Gene being tricked, maybe by someone asking for directions, as his father once speculated. Both vanished around the same time of year, August for Gene and September for Johnny. Both left behind their bags with their papers in them. Both were discovered missing only after customers complained of late deliveries, and in the years since, neither has ever been found. I know there's a lot in the Gosch case, which opens the door to different angles and speculation. From his mother's claim that Johnny returned years later to speak with her, and the discovery of the photographs left on her front step. There's a lot there which doesn't fit in with Gene. His family was never contacted by anyone who claimed to have been involved, they never heard from Gene again, and they never received any photos. I didn't want to focus primarily on Johnny here. His case has received a lot of attention, and there are countless podcasts and documentaries about it. But I do think there is some consideration to be given to what ties them together. I don't think you can entirely rule out the possibility that they were taken by the same person or persons. That being said, it doesn't give anyone much to work with. Rough descriptions, mostly vague and without the ability to define a single person. As Sergeant Mullen said at one point, the description could fit a lot of different people. I suppose what you have to do is look more at the targeted area, the process of the crimes, the way that were committed, and what the chances are that this could have been done by separate people. That's surely a possibility. It could be something as simple as someone knowing Johnny's story and in a sick and twisted way being inspired by it. However, that would seem to suggest some level of planning. The issue I have with it is neither of these crimes seems like they were truly planned out. Both Gene and Johnny typically did their roots in the company of someone older. For Johnny, it was his father, and for Gene, it was his older brother, 16 at the time. If someone had been watching either of them, they'd have no way of knowing that they were going to be alone that day. It seems more likely that someone in the area was paying attention to the delivery routes and times, and maybe figured there was a possibility that a child would be alone on any particular delivery morning. It seems too specific to be random. I mean, who's out driving around looking for a child to abduct between 5 and 6 a.m. on a Sunday if they're not doing it specifically targeting newspaper deliveries? All things considered, the less than 10 miles between them, the abductions happening nearly 2 years apart, almost to the day, both boys appearing similarly and being alone, it's difficult to imagine this was done by someone who wasn't local or didn't know the area that well. That just seems far too coincidental to be chalked up to an out-of-town person who just happens to strike in that same area twice. Many believe that whoever the abductor or abductors were, they either lived in Des Moines or had lived there in the past. There's also the possibility that this could have been a crime committed by someone who traveled seasonally, spending time in Des Moines areas during the summer and living elsewhere other times of the year. Some have argued it could have been someone directly connected to the newspaper delivery business, someone who would know those times and routes. That's surely a possibility, perhaps a disgruntled employee or a former newspaper boy himself. That's hard to say. There is one significant difference, though. While Johnny had been in the process of delivering papers, his wagon was found filled with papers just a few blocks from his home, Gene never got that far. His bag, loaded with freshly folded and banded papers, was found lying in the exact spot he had been sitting with it before he ever received the papers. We have that one witness driving to the golf course that morning who noted that Gene was sitting on the curb with an apparently empty carrier bag when he saw him. When his bag was found later, it was full, which suggests that Gene had stayed there, filled his bag, and then something stopped him from going on to deliver. Six witnesses claim to have seen Gene speaking with an older man in the area that morning. Only one witness reported seeing a car, and that witness was an anonymous caller who I don't think is actually considered a part of the investigation. At least, without corroboration, none of the sites discussing Gene's disappearance include any particular vehicle descriptions. For many, the scenario goes like this. Gene folds his papers and loads his bag. As he is either finishing up or getting ready to head off, the suspect comes walking up. He engages Gene in conversation, whether it's asking for directions or maybe pretending he's lost a dog and needs help. Whatever the method, he somehow convinces Gene to go along with him. Somewhere along the way, this man grabs Gene and forces him into a vehicle, at which point he speeds away. Remember, the search for Gene doesn't kick off until approximately 8:40 a.m., and if witnesses who saw the two together as late as 5:45 are accurate, that means by the time police are searching, the abductor has a nearly 3-hour head start. Depending on the speed and direction, you could get pretty far in a span of 3 hours. It's safe to imagine that if Gene was taken a good distance away, by the time police were searching, they're well over 100 miles down the road. There are other scenarios, of course. Some believe that Gene could have known his abductor, at least his family considered the possibility. Gene was extremely shy, and it was considered unlikely he'd have willingly approached an adult, though if the adult acted as though he was in distress or needed help, that could have changed things. Now, if Gene did know his abductor, that kind of changes the story. That would mean that Gene was targeted. And if it was by someone who knew him well, that person could also have known that he was out on his own that day. Unfortunately, because of the vague description, it's hard to rule anyone in or out. Obviously, his family would have been asked about anyone fitting that description, and as far as we know, they couldn't think of anyone. I also think it's important to note that Gene had come to that area of town only a few months earlier, in April, and according to his family, he rarely left home since he only knew a few kids in the area. He hadn't made that many friends, including ones on his own street. That seems to make it somewhat unlikely that he could have known his abductor, but that doesn't mean the abductor couldn't have been paying attention to him. If this was someone who was stalking the delivery routes, he may have seen Gene at some point in time. Maybe he decided ahead of time that he wanted to grab him, or maybe it was just a matter of opportunity that Gene happened to arrive all by himself that day. There are some reasons to think Gene himself wasn't targeted, at least not specifically. If he had been being watched, he could have been grabbed long before he arrived at work. Gene lived at 1905 Fraser Avenue, approximately a mile from where he was gathering newspapers. His walk would have taken him east down Fraser, south onto 18th, east on Kenyon, and then south on 14th. He also could have walked east on Fraser all the way to 18th and then turned south. Either way, there's a decent amount of space there where an abduction could have taken place. Then again, after Gene gathered up his papers, he'd have gone off to deliver them, entering various streets alone. That could also have presented an opportunity. So, it's somewhat strange that the abductor chose instead to target where Gene was sitting to begin with, unless he knew the routine and knew no one else would be coming along for a while, perhaps someone who worked in the newspaper business. Sure, the guy could have just been a weirdo creep who wasn't worried about getting caught, but this doesn't seem like the kind of crime pulled off by someone who doesn't have some desire to remain undetected. Again, though, it doesn't really take us anywhere. Once the abduction happens, we know almost nothing. Direction of travel, type of vehicle, did this person live in Des Moines, just outside, hundreds of miles away? I doubt the abductor still lived in the area, or if he did, I doubt he went straight home. It seems more likely the abductor would have planned to get a lot of distance between himself and what would ultimately become a search. If nothing else, the abductor had to have been aware of Johnny Gosch's case and figured that police weren't likely to be slow in responding the second time around. It's very difficult to analyze this case considering the utter lack of information about the crime and anything that might have happened afterward. There's a lot of debate about Gene's case, let alone Johnny's, and to try and skim through it all without much to go on is very much the proverbial needle in a haystack. Unfortunately, whoever performed these abductions, one person or different people, managed to do so in a way which left investigators nothing to work with, and they managed to avoid being spotted too directly, which probably made the 5 to 6 a.m. timeline a more tempting option. There is another theory that often comes up in these cases, most specifically in Johnny's, but it tends to be one which brings in a lot of speculation involving a pedophile ring, high-ranking members of government, and satanic rituals. I know it's a lot to look at, but if you've looked into Johnny Gosch's case, I'm sure you're familiar with that story. While my logical brain ignores it, there's also a part of me that remembers Jeffrey Epstein was just a conspiracy theory for a long time, too. I guess it becomes a matter of what you consider more likely. That someone who abducted Johnny also abducted Jean, that they were similar crimes executed by different people, or that it all ties back to some kind of weird satanic parties. I tend to follow Occam's razor and go with the simplest solution being the most likely, and in this case, I simply find it very difficult to believe that there is not a connection between the abductions of Jean Martin and Johnny Gosch. What that connection is, who was responsible, and whether or not we ever get those answers remains a mystery. Sadly, with 36 years having passed and no development since the early 1980s, this certainly feels like one of those cases where unless someone comes forward, new information is found, or a confession is made, the abduction of Jean Martin will remain open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the abduction of Jean Martin, there are many websites and newspaper articles discussing his case. You can look Eugene up on NCMEC under 601-815, on NamUs under MP6348, or on the DOE network at 34DMIA. If you have any information about the abduction of Eugene Martin, please contact the Des Moines Police Department at 515-237-1589. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. I'd like to take a moment now to thank our amazing Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne M. Bertram, Astrid Maria Nyer, Brett Eady, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Jessica Chagnon, Kevin Bonham, Megan Cotter, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah, Samantha Ford, Stephanie Eve, Stephen Weiland, Tara Doble, Tom Archer, Tracy Woods, and Travis Skepsko. You're all amazing and your contributions are greatly appreciated, as are all patrons. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or visit trace-evidence.com for further information. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.